He usually took someone with him, a nurse, a patient, another gambling buddy, to keep track of his winnings so he could concentrate on his game. When he hit it big, whoever was with him could count on getting a few thousand dollars from him to take back to Los Angeles. When he was losing, they sat helpless and watching. His nurse from the office was with him this time. As Robert's fortunes rose and fell by the hundreds with each bet, she started to notice something and tried to bring it to his attention. "You know," the nurse began, "seems like every time you get to $13,000 you start losing." That would not have been enough to stop him. It was not one of his better trips, but it was Vegas, and there was always another day. He was always playing to the crowd, knew all the casino workers, and loved it. Whatever he lost, he figured he would make it up tomorrow. One time, Jimmy Gay, the man who had introduced Robert to Vegas and had been a boyhood friend of Limuary's in the small world of Southerners in the L.A.-Vegas circuit, ran into Robert after a big win. Robert had $40,000 or $50,000 in front of him, and Jimmy wanted to intercede to keep him from losing it. "Bob, let me go put it up for you," Jimmy said. "No, I can handle my money," Robert shot back. "I'm a grown man. I don't need nobody to handle my money." A couple hours later, Robert came back, wanting to borrow $2,000. He done lost that $50,000 and wanted $2,000 to get it back, Limuary remembered. Bob squandered a fortune. But he seemed only to remember the times when he hit it big. It was what he lived for, like the time when a friend who went with him had to keep up with the kind of money you only heard of in bank robberies. "We brought back $53,000, Robert said of one trip in the 1970s. "He came back with a paper sack full of money," Limuary remembered, "and everybody knew his business owned the job, and he'd pay all the people he owed." But it was never really about the money for Robert. He had plenty coming in to begin with. It was hard, really, to know what it was about, except that he was weak for it, and that deep inside him was a Southerner with still a lot to prove. Gambling drew him, and he couldn't stay away. When he couldn't make it to Vegas, he bet on the horses at Santa Anita, or played blackjack in a bare gymnasium of a space over by the Hollywood Park racetrack, anywhere he could escape into the nerve-jangling uncertainty and the rare seconds of elation that lasted only long enough to reel him back in. He was handling sums of money that people back in Monroe could not fathom. "He won and lost several fortunes of a lifetime," Jimmy Marshall, his fellow migrant and friend, said. In the mid-90s, Robert, never a good driver to begin with, had a car accident, rammed into a median strip over on Crenshaw. He tore up his Cadillac. Someone came to help him out of the car. "Are you hurt?" the man asked. "No, I'm all right," Robert said. "Did you get your bottle?" the man asked, figuring, why else would someone ram into a median strip? "No, I don't drink," Robert told the man. Not anymore, anyway. He would not be able to drive anymore. He shouldn't have been driving in the first place, his friends would say. But that wasn't going to stop him from getting to wherever he needed to gamble, even in a city of expressways and little in the way of public transportation. He figured what he would do. "I'll take a taxi to the racetrack," he thought to himself. One day he summoned a cab to his house on Victoria. He got in and directed the driver to Hollywood Park racetrack. Then it hit him. Why go to Hollywood Park when he knew where he really wanted to go? "How much would it be to take me to Vegas?" he asked. The cab driver told him the fare. He told the driver to head to Vegas. That time he won big, which he would have needed in order to get home, and flew back to Los Angeles with a sack full of money. Triumph and self-esteem in a sack, to his mind. More north and west than south. "I could come back down to New Orleans for wonderful visits with my people, but I couldn't stay. Chicago and the north, where I was used to Negroes being more free, was where I belonged." Mahalia Jackson, Moving On Up. Chicago, 1978. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. Ida Mae settled into her role as the sweet-natured but no-nonsense matriarch of the family, now that her husband was gone. She had managed to recreate the village of extended family that existed on the plantations down south, her grown children and grandchildren surrounding her in the 3-flat they had been in now for more than a decade. The neighborhood had changed around them, had become all black and significantly poorer and more crime-ridden than it had been when they arrived. She and her family looked inward and lived their lives in the compound they created, her son, James, and his wife, Mary Ann, and their young children living on the first floor, Ida Mae living with Eleanor and her 2 children on the 2nd floor, and a tenant named Betty, who was almost like a daughter to her, on the 3rd floor. There was always a commotion now that Kevin and Karen were out of high school and just starting their lives, and Eleanor was divorced, but with a full social schedule of house parties and lady friends from back in high school and new boyfriends, the phone always ringing for Eleanor. Someone was always coming or going, wanting to know if the mail had arrived, if a job had come through, if a sweetheart had called yet, if a friend had said what time the party was, all of them expecting Ida Mae to keep up with this information, since she was retired and home most of the time, and bending down and giving her a peck on the cheek as they got their coat and headed for the door again. If they were all home at the same time, Kevin might be watching the White Sox in his room, Eleanor catching the news in hers, and Ida Mae watching a game show in the living room while keeping an eye on the drug busts and prostitutes on the street, which was usually better than any show on television anyway. There was a time back in Mississippi when nobody had a television. It hadn't been invented yet, and now everyone had one and retreated into his or her separate world. Holidays brought everyone together, especially Thanksgiving. It's not clear whether anybody gave it any thought, but turkeys had been one of the reasons they were in Chicago in the first place. Maybe they would have come to Chicago anyway. It was just meant to be. In any case, in the fall of 1977, Ida Mae's family was chosen out of all the families on the South Side to represent the typical Chicago family at Thanksgiving. Someone at Jewel, the Chicago supermarket chain, knew someone who knew Ida Mae's family, knew James and Mary Ann, knew they were good, solid people, and that Ida Mae was beloved by all who came in contact with her. Jewel brought a camera crew to their 3-flat in South Shore. The dining room table was draped with white lace and candles, filled with platters of green beans and cranberry sauce and sweet potato pie, and a roasted turkey at the head of the table. James, with a mustachioed grin and his mother's narrow face, Mary Ann in auburn curls and a white silk blouse, and 3 of their 4 children sat smiling and happy as if in dinner-time conversation around the dining room table. A photographer captured the moment. The picture ran as a full-page ad for Jewel Food Stores in the Chicago Metro News on Saturday, November 26, 1977. The headline read, "Platters Full of Plenty Thanks." Near the center of the picture was Ida Mae with a platter full of salad, standing at the head of the table in a polyester dress, her white hair in a French twist, her big goggle glasses taking up most of her face. Her eyes looked directly into the camera, and she smiled as if unburdened and free, despite the turmoil outside her front windows. For now, she was taking up a whole page in an ad out of Norman Rockwell, in a city that had resisted people like her coming north, and for one brief holiday weekend, had made it to the big time in Chicago. New York, 1978. George Swanson Starling. Inez was gone, but the church women bearing homemade pound cakes held little interest for George Starling. Inez was the only woman he would ever consider as a wife, however unhappy they had been. Now that she was gone, he was left to watch helplessly as the children he was not around enough to raise got themselves into fixes. He would try to impart wisdom from what he had learned from his own mistakes to children and grandchildren who did not appear anxious to hear it. He was getting to be looked upon as just an old man from the South. What did he know of the frustrations of being young and black and wanting to be somebody and all the temptations and obstacles they faced? and what it took to survive. He had been the one to set the course of their lives by migrating to New York before they were born. The parts of the city that black migrants could afford, Harlem, Bedford-Stuyvesant, the Bronx, had been hard and forbidding places to raise children, especially for some of the trusting and untutored people from the small town south. The migrants had been so relieved to have escaped Jim Crow that many underestimated or dared not think about the dangers in the big cities they were running to. The gangs, the guns, the drugs, the prostitution. They could not have fully anticipated the effects of all these things on children left unsupervised, parents off at work, no village of extended family to watch over them, as might have been the case back in the South. Many migrants did not recognize the signs of trouble when they surfaced, and so could not inoculate their children against them, or intercede effectively when the outside world seeped into their lives. George's two children would come to resent the overcrowding and the vice and concrete, the people on top of one another, and the perils all around. Both Gerard and Sonia would succumb to them in one form or another, then run from the toxic influences that caught root in the city. They would move to Florida, the old country, by the 1980s, Sonia to Eustis of all places, which she found smaller and after the death of Jim Crow more welcoming, and Gerard to Miami, where he made unheard-of sums of money dealing drugs during the cocaine boom, falling deeper into the drug world he was initiated into as a boy in New York. Gerard blamed New York for the road he had taken, and he hated the city for it, unable to own up to the choices he himself had made. "If I hadn't been born and raised in New York," he once told his cousin Pat, "I never would have been on drugs. I wouldn't have lived the life that I lived. I hate New York." Both of George's children went in the opposite direction from the one George had taken, went back to the place he had left and made decisions he couldn't understand. It was as if their return was a rebuke to his attempt to spare them the pain he had endured and to give them chances at decent schools and work options other than fruit picking, choices he himself had never had growing up. George would rarely talk about his children, so great was his disappointment. The one constant in his life was the job on the railroad that took him along the path of the great migration he had made himself back during the war. Down and back, south and north, New York to Florida and New York again. He was 60 years old and had been working the rails for 35 years. How many times had he plied this route? Passed through Wildwood, Jacksonville, Savannah, Raleigh, Richmond, and Washington, and on up to New York, again and again. How many thousands of migrants had he helped up the train steps carrying their luggage? How much history had he seen unfolding in the faces of the people boarding those trains? He was nearing retirement, and was doing precisely the same thing now that he was when he was 25. He had not moved up or been promoted in all those years. He had tried to propose to his superiors improvements in service since he was in a position to see up close exactly what the passengers needed. But nothing ever came of it. He learned to accept his lot, and it got to the point where he just stopped applying for positions like conductor or ticket taker that it was clear he wasn't going to get. Toward the end of his career, he got to be in charge of the luggage in the club cars, but it was really not much different than before. As he had done when he first started, he would walk from one end of the train to the other all night long. He could rarely sit and never sleep during a 24-hour run. All through the night, he had to take people's luggage at every stop and put it away and reposition it and pull out the luggage for passengers disembarking. He walked back and forth, up and down. Sometimes he would take Inez's niece Pat with him on those night runs. He would get her settled in her seat and go to work. "There never was a time that I saw him sleep," she remembered. "He never complained. It wasn't a gravy job and it was beneath his dignity. He never got a chance to use his mind. When he first started, it was an honor to be a porter on that train at that time. But in reality, it wasn't nothing but hard labor." The Great Migration had played out before his very eyes. Now it was coming to a close from a demographic, macroeconomic point of view. On the ground, it was maturing, The migrants and their families situated in the north, no longer nervous and starry-eyed, missing their stop or getting off too early or by accident in Newark. Now he was watching and helping the grown children and grandchildren of the migration make their way back to the old country. The ways of the north had settled into most of them. Many of his passengers were born and raised in the north and were making their first visits to the south rather than returning to a place they had known. He could tell the original migrants. They were requiring more help getting up the steps, beginning to need canes, many still speaking in their southern accents. They were the ones sitting up straighter, more alert, their memories awakened when they passed the fields of tobacco and cotton, the small church-steepled towns along the way, and the groves of orange trees that George knew so well, because mean and ornery as it may have been, the South was still the old country, the land where their fathers and mothers were buried, and these original migrants were heading home to it, at least for now. Los Angeles, 1978. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. Robert, a widower nearing 60 now, had landed what would seem the perfect position. He was doing precisely what had been denied him back in Louisiana. He was on staff at a hospital, and not just any hospital. He was physician to the staff of the West Los Angeles Veterans Administration Medical Center in Brentwood. It took up 22 acres between UCLA and the Brentwood Country Club. Its curving drives were named after the great generals of history, MacArthur, Patton, Pershing, the name he had gone for by the first half of his life. It was bigger and better than St. Francis, the small town hospital that had rejected doctors who looked like him during the days of Jim Crow and had given him one more reason to leave the South. It would be vindication for all that he had endured back home. He would make less than when he was in private practice, when he was limited only by the hours in the day and the energy he could muster. But he no longer had to concern himself with patient billing and office leases and could concentrate on what he loved most, doting on his patients, the employees at the VA hospital. Immediately, he set about getting to know everyone. Some of the staff took to him right away, especially the few black ones who had migrated from the South like he had. Before long, he was carpooling with some of them to get to work. They quickly learned that his other love was gambling, and they could tell when he had just gotten back from Vegas. They would drive up to his mansion early in the morning and toot the horn. Robert would scramble down the walkway, silk suit pressed and necktie in place, limping in his stocking feet with his dress shoes in his hand. He brought his crushed velvet jitterbug demeanor to the gray, humorless bureaucracy of a government hospital. He put his feet up on his desk as he always had and asked about his patient's complaints and worries before pulling out his stethoscope. He had built an entire practice on understanding his patient's personal troubles so that he could get to the bottom of their medical ailments, as he saw one as being connected to the other. Migrants from the South treasured his bedside manner and had made up the majority of the patients in his private practice. But Robert was now in a world more like the one he worked in as an army doctor in Austria during the Korean War. Most of the patients, meaning the hospital staff members, were bureaucrats or military and not of his background. Some had come from the South in the parallel migration of whites seeking their own fortune in the wide-open world of California during the years of the Great Migration. The whole enterprise was an adjustment for Robert. He was used to being in charge and the center of attention, running his office as he pleased. Now he had to be at work by 8 in the morning. Bureaucrats wouldn't put up with what his adoring working-class patients would accept. They wouldn't put up with him coming in on a morning flight from Vegas, rushing in late with his silk suits and sacks full of money. He couldn't charm his way into everyone's good graces by offering to pick up everybody's lunch tab with his winnings. "That didn't work when you were working for another man," said Lemuary Jordan's wife Adeline, one of Robert's sometime critics. "You got to follow his orders. You just don't come and walk over them like that." His breezy airs did not sit well with some of the bureaucrats and their assistants. His being one of the few blacks in authority could have put him under perhaps even greater scrutiny. The bureaucrats began complaining about him, and soon he clashed with one hospital worker in particular. It may never be known precisely what happened. The military would not disclose details of the dispute, and Robert took the Hippocratic Oath so literally that he rarely spoke of the specifics of any one patient. There were no legal charges against him, and he received workers' compensation for the distress he suffered. But trouble flared, his colleagues said, after a white woman patient at the hospital complained about an examination. Robert had managed to survive decades in the Jim Crow South without crossing a white woman, and had actually won the gratitude of one from Kentucky when he interceded in her delivery and helped her avoid a cesarean section. Now, decades later, after he had built a name for himself and had taken a job he did not need, he was running into the very thing he had come to California to escape. There were whispers within the hospital of professional incompetency, perhaps the one thing he had never been accused of in his life. Robert refused to give up his position, but it would be only a Pyrrhic victory. The hospital, he reported, moved him from the offices that he and the white doctors who preceded him had worked out of. It transferred him to an older building, in a cramped examining room next to a loud lavatory reeking with urine and feces, he wrote in the mid-1990s in a letter of complaint to the Labor Department. It was as if he had been hurled back 50 years to the Paramount Theater back in Monroe. It was nearing the eve of the 21st century, and it seemed as if Jim Crow would not die. His every move was scrutinized, and the stress of the isolation weighed on him more heavily than anything in his life. He had made it to the paradise he had so believed in all those decades ago that he had bragged about it even before seeing it. Now it had betrayed him in ways he could not have imagined. He told his friends and family of his plight, and the plight of co-workers who had also migrated from the South and were now helpless as they witnessed what was happening to him. He was so incensed that he complained to the Labor Department about the personal isolation, professional and personal slights, rumors and professional slander he was enduring. He described a continuous, racist and stressful environment, language that he rarely used in all his descriptions of life in the South. He had given his life over to his patients to the detriment of his own family, a decision that would weaken his ties to his daughters and grieve him later in life when his choices could not be undone. He had sat at the bedside of patients who loved him for his devotion, and now a new one had turned on him and threatened the reputation that had taken him a lifetime to build. Things only got worse. In seeking workers' compensation, Robert was required to be evaluated by a psychiatrist with ties to the VA hospital. The psychiatrist seemed to dismiss what Robert told him, and directed Robert to prove to him the difference in the size of Robert's old office and the smaller one to which he had been demoted. The psychiatrist proceeded to command me to step forward, Robert wrote, pick up a commercial tape from his desk, and stoop down in a servile manner to measure his office for square footage. Something about a surgeon being commanded by anyone to stoop to the floor and take measurements brought back memories of the surring and mamming back in the South, and made him feel lower than at any time since perhaps his migration through the desert. I am humiliated and ensnared in an evaluation process which is untenable, Robert wrote. He had never wanted to make a federal case out of the times in his life he had been ill-treated because of the caste into which he had been born and the era in which he lived. But here he was making a plea to the government as he fought for his good name. The stress forced him to seek treatment from a cardiologist and from vascular and orthopedic surgeons and a psychiatrist. They told him he needed to quit to protect his health. But Robert did not want to go out that way, not after all he had been through, proving himself at every turn, starting with the decision to migrate in the first place. The only good thing about the situation was that Rufus Clement had not lived to see it. Surely he would have told him that this was proof of what Clement had believed all along, that Robert would have been better off casting his lot in the South. Better, too, that Big Madison hadn't lived to see it either. Surely he would have shed a tear for his little brother who loved medicine and worked so hard at pleasing everyone. The dispute dragged on for years as Robert sought relief through workers' compensation for the toll the situation had taken on his health. One day in the middle of this episode in his life, he was walking down the red-carpeted aisle toward the club room at Santa Anita when it felt as if he were being stabbed in the chest. He was suffering a heart attack. He would require bypass surgery and would see his life slow down considerably. He would soon take his own physician's advice and retire from the VA hospital. It was not how he wanted to end his career. The memory of what he felt was a forced ouster in his adopted home would stay with him for the rest of his life. He had seen roadblocks to black progress even in his beloved California. "And it's harder and heavier the higher the paycheck," he said. As for Robert's reputation, the one he fought so hard to maintain during his dispute with the hospital, it remained as it had always been. Patients from the VA hospital continued to see him, dropping by the house on Victoria to seek his advice. And many years later, the State Medical Board in Sacramento showed the record of Dr. Robert P. Foster to be free of any sanctions during the 44 years he was licensed to practice medicine in the state of California. But he would never see California the same. He would have many moments of joy from the old patients who consulted him and brought their children for him to examine and allay their worries long after he had retired. But he would never get over what befell him. He was dying on the inside, his friend and patient Melissa Briley said. Redemption. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17. 1. Chicago, summer 1996. Ida Mae Gladney is 83 years old when I first meet her. She is a church-going pensioner with time on her hands. She spends most of her days alone while everyone else is out working. She does word puzzles and crosswords, whole paperback books of them, to keep her mind sharp. She collects the funeral programs of the people she knew and loved in Mississippi and Chicago, who are, one by one, passing away, getting extras for other mourners the way young people collect business cards and email addresses. It is the currency of the old. In the meantime, she manages to keep up with the job pursuits and love lives of her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She has little interest in soap operas and doesn't need to watch police dramas on television. She has one right outside her window. Hers is a bow front window, curved like a movie screen. She can monitor the street day or night from her box seat, which is actually a baby blue plastic-covered easy chair by the front window on the second floor of her three-flat. Things are happening that she never saw growing up in Mississippi, and she isn't always certain of exactly what it is she is looking at. She is watching the street from her window the afternoon I meet her. A man is selling drugs out of a trash can. She can see, plain as day, where he puts them and how he gets them out of the trash for the white customers in their SUVs with suburban license plates. Another hides his stash in his mouth. And when customers come up, he pulls a piece of his inventory from his tongue to sell to them. The police are onto it, too. "The police put flashlights down their mouth," she says. "Sometimes the police make them stoop over." A man is climbing out of an old Pontiac he sleeps in. He and the car have been outside her house for weeks. A teenage mother has just popped her son for something Ida Mae can't make out, because a car passes by just when the mother yells something at the boy. Usually it's M.F. or G.D., Ida Mae says, and it hurts her to see people do that to their children. "The other night," she says, "she was setting out the trash and saw a woman on her knees in the alley doing something to a man who was up against the garage. I was looking for her head, and I never did see it," Ida Mae says. She didn't know exactly what the woman was doing, but she knew they shouldn't have been doing it and knew better than to say anything, and thought it best to go back inside. I just can't get it out of my mind, she says. When the police aren't around, the people are out in the street like characters in a cable television drama, and the drug dealers are up and down the block. But mostly at the corner where there was once an ice cream parlor, back when she first moved here. These are the lost grandchildren of the migration, who have grown hard in the big city and did not absorb the lessons of the past or the good to be found in the steadying rituals and folk wisdom of the South. Ida May and James and Eleanor can't understand how they do the things they do, how they would rather trawl the streets than go to work every day and be able to hold their heads high. Something about too many people packed together and nothing to guide them makes the children worse than they used to be, to her mind. At the moment, the city is in a crisis because two grade schoolers, one of them only 7, have been accused of killing another child. Nobody knows for sure what happened, and she certainly couldn't say. But she knows one thing for sure. They curse like sailors, they throw rocks, they do everything they big enough to do. They ain't got no home training, and they mama can't do nothing 'cause she on drugs. That 7-year-old, they say he was the ringleader. He know more than he telling. But they shouldn't put them in the penitentiary. They too young. They not gonna ever forget it. She keeps going. I know kids, 'cause I been one, she says. I used to tease this girl that her mama was dead. I think about that a lot sometimes. She held that against me the rest of her life. She used to cry when I said it. I didn't know what it was to lose a mother. I had lost my father. I thought everyone should die. I was 9 or 10 years old. I was bad. Now they double worse. But go in the wash, come out in the rain. Watch what I say now. You got to start working on those little ones early. I ain't got much education, but I show no folks. I ain't scared of these kids, but I stay out of their way. The craziness has Ida May hemmed in on all sides. When she leaves to go to church, if she goes to buy groceries, if she takes a walk to get some exercise, the drug dealers and lookout boys greet her as she leaves and welcome her when she gets back. When she hears sirens or gunshots, she runs to the window to see what has happened now. She is an eyewitness to a war playing out on the streets below her. Staying on top of everything is how she makes peace with the craziness she cannot escape. She would never dream of going outside at night by herself, but it is not because she is afraid of the gangbangers and the drug dealers. She speaks to them and prays for them, and in turn they look out for her. They call her grandma and tell her not to come out on certain days. You better stay in the house, they tell her, because we don't know what time we gonna start shooting. On a July afternoon, she is telling her story about the ride up north and making her way in Chicago in those early days. We are in the middle of a conversation when something crashes outside the window. It rattles me, and I look toward the window to see what it might be. Ida May does not flinch. She has learned the difference between danger and mischief, between a gunshot and a rock through a window. Whatever it was, it's as if it didn't happen. Did you hear that? I ask her. Sounds like some glass broke. Honey, they does that. They throw bottles at each other. You didn't even look up. I hear too much of it, she says. I'd be looking all day. She lets out a big laugh. Every day, there is something or other. On an otherwise quiet afternoon, we look out the window and see 2 police officers leading a black man in a white windbreaker and baseball cap, hands cuffed, down the sidewalk in front of the apartment building next door. That's the janitor, she tells me. He works there. Wonder what did he do? He lopes along, head up, scanning the street like a politician on a tour of his district. He looks both ways before stepping off the curb to cross the street to the patrol car. He nods his respects to the teenage girls walking past. Ida May doesn't know what he has done, but figures she'll find out in due course. People talk, she says. You don't have to ask. She has an idea of what it was, There was a raid in the building a few weeks before. The police took 17 or 18 people out in handcuffs.
Did it at night, she says. They carried them all out tied together. I got tired of counting. You know, that still ain't stopped them. They still up in there. I don't know what'll stop them. I guess the Lord knows.
She watches and makes note of what's going on around her. Every month there's a neighborhood crime watch meeting, and she is sure to attend. Trouble is, she believes some of the police are not much better than the criminals.
The detectives are the ones doing the dirt, she says.
Somehow some of the dealers are onto the police, or get forewarning of their arrival.
They have a phone, she says. They know when the police coming.
Still, she manages to stay out of everybody's way. She may be stuck in her own home, but she has too much faith or stubbornness to let fear take over.
I ain't gonna live nowhere scared, she says. I ain't calling the police, long as they don't bother me. If I know what's going on, they do too.
And she refuses to put bars on the windows.
My husband say he never be behind no bars, she says, and neither am I.
2. Harlem, 1996. It requires descending down a narrow set of stairs into an airless vestibule in the basement of a 3-story brownstone to get to where the owner lives. He has taken the dankest, darkest space for himself and given over the rest of the building, the rooms with light and space, to whatever tenants he has. George Starling never cared about creature comforts and finery, but about getting a square deal, which he on occasion achieved, and the right to exercise the free will he was not permitted in the South. His life is scattered in boxes all over his room, file folders stuffed with pictures of him and Inez as teenagers in Florida, mimeographed copies of his lawyerly letters to the railroad or union leaders about this or that provision or instance of inequality, and the funeral programs of loved ones who have passed away. He is 78 now, a grandfather and great-grandfather, a deacon in the church. He sits upright and stoic. He enunciates each syllable in this early conversation and speaks in the deliberate and formal manner of the professor he once wanted to be. But the longer he talks, the more comfortable he gets, and the more he sounds like the southerner he is inside. He feels it is his responsibility to share what he knows and takes it upon himself to explain whatever he says in the greatest detail. He talks for 45 patient and exacting minutes about what it takes to pick string beans and describes the difference between the walking buds, the junior buds, the uncle buds, and the seedling trees he used to pick back in Florida. A car pulls up. It's his pastor, Reverend Henry Harrison, dropping by to see Deacon Starling. The pastor, hearing the topic of the South and the migration, begins telling the story of how his father escaped from a labor camp in South Carolina by swimming through a swamp and eventually in 1930 finding his way to New York. Both men start to lament the changes all around them, the sadder effects of the big city of the North on the people of the South. George waxes on about the days when people would come down to 135th Street with their house chairs, and they would baptize people in the Harlem River.
We used to have a boat ride off 125th Street in the Dykeman section, he says. Spread the blankets out. Midsummer, people didn't have air conditioning. People would stay up there all night and play card games.
Things were so much different, he says. Drugs wasn't heard of where I came from. When I came to New York, I didn't know what a reefer was.
We got to being Americanized, Reverend Harrison is saying. It got to where we don't help each other.
George has children and grandchildren, and even a great-grandchild now, but there is an aloneness to the character of his life. He seems content in the solitude of his room, with its dust-covered floor, barely made bed, and no sign of a woman's touch. He seems on a mission to sort through the paperwork of his life, find some meaning in all the railroad pamphlets and official letters he wrote on behalf of workers' rights that were politely dismissed or not acted upon. His face turns ashen and he looks away when the subject turns to his children and grandchildren.
His son by Inez had squandered the very opportunities George had left the South for, and he had limited contact with the now grown son he had outside his marriage. Then there was the daughter Sonia. She was sweet but unsettled, too, back and forth between Florida and New York. George had been having heart trouble and had just come out of triple bypass surgery when he got word that Sonia had died in a car accident down in Eustis. He flew down to Florida for the funeral. The people who had stayed in the South gathered around to console him. "We would be in a room with a crowd of people," his niece Pat said, "and he would get up and leave the room. He'd come back and just carry on the conversation. You knew he had been crying." He buried his daughter next to his wife. 3. Los Angeles, Spring, 1996. This is the 1970s set piece known as Dr. Robert Foster's Living Room. It is a room that is little changed, you learn, from the time when his wife Alice was alive. You are encased in cream and raspberry upholstery, seafoam carpet, and harvest gold draperies cascading down from 10-foot ceilings, more space than one person could possibly need, and by that measure alone, the very picture of success in California. The host has momentarily disappeared down a hall and into the avocado green and harvest gold kitchen. He emerges, taking care with his steps, with a tray of lemon pound cake with vanilla ice cream, which you would really prefer not to take, since you have only just eaten, but it is clear from the formality with which he presents it, and then watches as you pick up the fork, that there is no choice but to accept this gesture of hospitality. In a bookcase there are volumes of Tolstoy, Freud, Goethe, and Herodotus. On his face is a smile of satisfaction at the interest being taken in a life he loves to talk about. You learn the basics of what he wishes you to know about his growing up in Monroe, marrying the daughter of a university president, leaving the South for California, about the three daughters and now the grandchildren, the gambling and the current state of his health, and how he views the world as a Southern emigre in California. Those things will be fleshed out in due time, over the course of several months. You learn that right now he has heart problems, has already had bypass surgery. "The chest pain is growing more frequent," he says, "but I'm not going to have another operation. If anything happened to me tomorrow, I wouldn't have any regrets. I have lived. I've done it all. The world don't owe me nothing." He is retired from the practice of medicine and spends most of his time at the blackjack tables or on the phone dispensing free medical advice to former patients and old friends, or ordering around a gardener who indulges his every whim as to precisely where the begonias should be. Years before, Robert woke up the morning of his oldest daughter's wedding, and instead of taking his time dressing in his tuxedo, he got out and had the front yard dug up to plant flowers to match Bunny's wedding bouquet. Now, on this late spring afternoon, he was fretting over the backyard. "Now turn it a little more," he was telling the gardener one day about a particular pot of geraniums. "Not to the left, to the right, to the right." He has come all this way and is living in a 3,600-square-foot monument to his success in California. But the most enduring accomplishments you cannot see. The cooks and teachers and postal workers all over Southern California who would do just about anything for him because he had saved their lives or brought them into the world or repaired some broken piece of themselves. And the three daughters whom he spared from having to go to segregated schools in the South and who grew up free with their cotillions in California. The daughters lead upper-middle-class lives, had married well, if not long, and have children who can only be said to be brilliant. Bunny is now working as an artist's agent in Chicago. Robin is a city manager who is living outside Washington with her second husband and her son, who is being courted by the Ivies. The youngest daughter, Joy, is a physician, a radiologist, married to a day trader, and has two precocious young children in Long Beach, about 30 miles south of Robert. Alice never got to see the fruits of her labor, and at weddings and holidays, it falls to Robert to be mother and father, neither of which he is naturally suited for. but he rises to the occasion when called upon to do so. When Joy brought home a young man she appeared to be serious about, Robert stepped forward as a father protecting his youngest. He asked the young man, Lee Ballard, to go out for a drive to the dry cleaners with him. He made it sound like a request, which of course it was not. Lee climbed into Robert's white Cadillac, and Robert began driving, erratic as usual. Then Robert began his inquiries.
"How do you like California?"
he asked Lee once they were on their way.
"And how do you plan to take care of my daughter?"
The drive lasted 2 hours. The beaux survived the drive and ended up marrying Robert's youngest daughter. The marriage would last longer than those of the other girls. The telephone rings. It's the third or fourth time in the space of a couple of hours. The phone usually starts ringing around 3 or 4 o'clock, after people get home from seeing their new doctors. Robert excuses himself to take the call in the kitchen. It's another friend and former patient calling about an ailment and how best to treat it, and to check to see if his new doctor is prescribing the right medication. Robert indulges the man, addresses his worries, gives him advice.
"Demerol is the name of it,"
Robert is telling the person on the other end of the line.
"Now put something in your stomach."
The person has more questions for Robert about what he's been prescribed.
"Percodan? Any of those things nauseate the heck out of you," Robert tells him. "Take as little medicine as you can."
The person interrupts, and Robert listens.
"Take your aspirin," Robert tells him.
The person cuts in again, still expressing concern. Robert reassures him.
"Sounds like you're going to be all right, Phil. God bless you."
Eustis, Florida, July 1996. George Swanson Starling. Some 51 years have passed since the standoff in the central Florida citrus groves that almost got George Starling killed. He has lived out his life in New York. The grove owners he stood up to are long dead, as is the High Sheriff Old Willis McCall, who lorded over Lake County with a Smith & Wesson and a 10-gallon hat. George has felt it safe to come back to visit, and is now sitting at a diner out by Ocala with his old friend Reuben Bly, who was one of George's picking foremen back in the 40s. They both had lived up north. Reuben, at age 89, is now living back in Florida with his sixth wife, having survived the treachery of the South and the temptations of the North, and is at this moment reliving those days with George, who is back in town for a high school reunion.
"Do you know a Florida man got more sense than a born New Yorker, George?"
Reuben asks, not really looking for George to answer.
"You know that?"
"I had never given it a thought that way."
"One that's been around like us, George. We know our way around better than some of them up there."
"Well, you had to have a lot of sense to learn how to survive down here during those times, to stay out of trouble, you know."
"George, you done run that railroad so long up and down from coast to coast on the train," Reuben says. "And look how we travel. Look at Rube. Done travel, done made 37 states. I already had it in my head. You don't get me every day."
As torn as George was about his time in Florida, he had never truly left it in his mind. Ever since his father had died, he had kept a little piece of property in Eustis, vacant land with live oaks and scrub brush near the house where his father had run the little convenience store. He never knew exactly what he would do with it, and had no plans to live there ever again. He just liked the idea of having control over something in a place that had controlled his every step for so long.
"When I left, I swore that I would never come back under no circumstances any more," he said. "When I left, I was just that bitter. I didn't intend to come back at all."
10 years passed before he felt it safe to return. The deaths and illnesses lured him back, and he began to see how the South seemed to be changing, in small ways and big ways, right before his eyes.
"I never thought I would live to see the day," he said of some of the strides being made. "If anybody told me that there would be a black mayor in Birmingham, I would have told them they were crazy.
Now they have black mares all over the place down south. How many black mares we got up north?
He had once seen a black man and a white woman walking down the street in downtown Tavares, the county seat and the domain of old Willis McCall. George was having a hard time getting used to seeing what could have gotten him killed in his day.
I never thought I'd see the day when a black man would walk down the street holding hands with a white woman, he said. It amazes me when I see them intermingling. When I was a boy down here, when you went through the white neighborhood, you had to be practically running. Now black people are living in there. They all mixed up with the whites right there in Eustace.
We are riding through Eustace and out to the orange groves near Sanford and the train station in Wildwood where the relatives would come to greet George when his train passed through. He and Reuben are returning to the places where they picked oranges and okra, the places they could and couldn't go, and where the black people lived. Reuben does most of the directing because he has been living back in Florida for several years now. George sits up and starts pointing when he sees something he recognizes.
They used to baptize us down here, George says as we wind past Lake Eustace. To the left are the water oak trees.
We drive farther out. The land is wild scrub brush broken by stands of domed trees, the citrus that ruled their lives growing up.
Over to the right, over here, was woods, George says, just like you see to the right, but they cleared that up.
Here go the seedling groves, Reuben says.
Is that Lake Ale there?
That Lake Ale. Those seedling groves right in here had all them pecan trees.
Was this the natural, George asks, of the legendary grove that has withstood the worst winters and hardest of freezes?
The natural's out there by Emeraldi Island.
I told you Reuben would know where everything is, George says, turning in my direction.
If you dropped an orange in the natural grove, 5 minutes and it would just be hitting the ground. You could get up in one of those trees and look all over this South Florida.
This is old Jones's place.
I picked in that grove where I had a 36-foot ladder spliced with a 26-foot ladder, and it just reached the bottom limb.
That's right.
All us here, Charlie Mudd, me, we used to hunt coons and possum long here.
We drive further and further out.
This here's old Cannon Grove.
This is not the way it looked before the last big freeze, George says. This is new. They reset. They put new trees there.
All this here was froze out.
1989 it snowed in Florida. Had 2 and 3 inches of snow.
Have you ever seen a forest that would burn out with a fire?
George asks me.
Well, that's just the way those trees look. Them trees look just like somebody went through there with a flamethrower.
George comes back to Eustace every 2 years for the biennial reunion of Curtwright Colored High School. He always comes down on the train he once worked. It's owned by Amtrak now, and as a pensioner with 35 years of service, he gets to ride for free. He can finally sit like the passengers he served and look out the window to see what they saw, reliving with each trip the migration he made all those years ago. When George returns to Eustace, he is looked upon with a distant kind of respect. He was one of them once, but he chose a different path, knows things they couldn't know, survived in a place where they're not sure they could make it. He's been gone so long that whatever he knows about Eustace is either frozen in the 1940s or distorted through the second-hand recounting in long-distance phone calls and letters and rumor. He's fuzzy on some of the names of the people who live there now. Whole generations have been born since he left, and he searches out his connections to them, the ways he might know them, through a grandparent, great-aunt, or second cousin of theirs whom he grew up with but who may not be around anymore. He stays with Viola, the widow of his deceased stepbrother, and spends much of his time visiting with the few people who were around when he was here, reliving those days and catching up on the things he has missed. When people hear that he's in town, they head over to Viola's bungalow and remove their hats before they walk in to see a prodigal son of Eustace.
It is Sunday on the July weekend of the high school reunion, and George puts on his burgundy polyester suit, burgundy tie, burgundy socks, and white straw hat to worship at the church he grew up in as a boy, and where the doomed Harry T. Moore recruited him in the early drive for equal rights. 70 parishioners take their places in the dark wood pews affixed to orange carpet. Pastor William Hawkins beseeches the congregation to take up a special plate for the black churches that have recently been burned throughout the South. It is as if it is 1963 again. "We ought to do something to assist them," he says, "and this is one of the reasons we'd better secure our own church." People pull out money to give to the other churches and pray that they won't be next. The choir motions for George to come forward and sing the solo for the collection. "What you give, what more he gives to you," he sings. Then the pastor turns to George. "We are always glad to see our member from New York," Reverend Hawkins says, motioning to George to come to the pulpit to speak. George stands before the congregation of mostly new faces, the descendants of those he knew, and looks around at a church that was as much a part of him as the South itself. "Needless to say, I am grateful to be in your midst," he says. "I look over and see my father and my mother and my daughter, and it always makes me a little full. So if I become emotional, I hope you will understand." He then sings a hymn, "Without God I could do nothing, without him I would fail." The congregation claps after he finishes, and he takes his glasses off and wipes the tears with his handkerchief before walking back to his seat at the side of the church. He takes his place and sits upright in a pew next to the pulpit with a silver cane beside him and tears escaping from his eyes. Los Angeles, November 23rd, 1996. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. The regularly scheduled bi-monthly meeting of the Monroe, Louisiana Club of Los Angeles, California, is not so much called to order as roused to life when 10 of the 16 surviving and currently active members trickle into the bungalow of Leo and Era Davis on 93rd Street, east of Crenshaw. They gather in the Davis's den with a circular metal staircase and prepare to catch up with one another and with news from back home in Monroe. It is surely one of the smallest Louisiana clubs in the city, not to mention its being overshadowed by all the Texas clubs around town. "We're a dying breed," says Lemuary Jordan, a club member who left Louisiana in his DeSoto more than a half a century before. "It's a fact. Everybody in the club is over 60, and without any new Monroe people. There are Monroe people here, but they don't affiliate with us. They don't belong to no club. So we are of a particular time." "A lot of them don't have anything to do with the South," his wife Adeline says. "A lot of them, when they left, they were gone." The few members who are still active approach the club with a sense of formality and ritual. Robert Foster had to secure approval beforehand to invite a guest who brings the attendance at today's meeting to 11. As the graying expatriates from Monroe begin to take their seats, I explain my presence as his guest and tell them about my work on the Great Migration. They listen without emotion or much in the way of comment, not seeing exactly what the migration has to do with them, even though they had all been right in the middle of it. At the appointed hour, John Collins, whom they call just Collins, stands up like a proper reverend and prays stiffly in his black suit and gray vest and fedora. "Lord, we thank you for this food we are about to receive, and we thank you for another day," he begins. "We pray for the lady visitor and the book she's trying to put together. Give her knowledge and wisdom, and watch over her. In Jesus' name, amen." Spread out before the assembled are oxtails, collard greens, cornbread, sweet potatoes, potato salad, red beans and rice, and pound cake on an orange tablecloth in the wood-paneled dining room. It is a time of unaccustomed quiet in the city after so much upheaval. The Rodney King beating, police acquittals, and ensuing riots were only a few years back.
the business districts of South Central still in recovery. The people have been divided and whipsawed by the O.J. Simpson trial, the saga of a once-loved black football player acquitted of killing his white wife and her friend, the people by now just wishing the whole thing would go away.